Good morning, everyone. We are going to get started. I know we're going to have people still filtering in, but we have a great panel today. I know we're going to have a lot of questions, so I want to make the most of the time. So thank you all for joining us today. I'm excited for the conversation ahead with our amazing panelists, who I will introduce momentarily. I'm Lindsay Smith. My pronouns are she and her, and I'm a freelance journalist and the managing editor of DSmog. DSmog is a publication founded nearly 20 years ago. I like to round up, so it's like actually 16, but that is dedicated to clearing the PR pollution that is clouding the science and solutions to climate change. We'll start today with a panel discussion about carbon capture and storage, and we will leave ample time for your questions at the end. You've heard it all before, but I'm going to say it again. SEJ has asked me to remind you that this is a conference created by and for journalists, and therefore journalists, members of SEJ, and other journalism organizations have priority in asking questions. Thank you for respecting that policy. So our panelists today are not sitting in the order in which they're on my paper, so there's going to be some shuffling. But to my right is Chris DiGiulio, whose pronouns are she and they. Chris is an environmental chemist for Physicians for Social Responsibility Pennsylvania, where she collects data to help validate the health impacts from the oil and gas industry. She is also a certified thermographer for optical imaging using the FLIR optical gas imaging camera to capture hydrocarbon releases and leaks across Pennsylvania. She has previously worked as a civilian federal employee and contractor for the Department of Defense as an analytical chemist. Chris also serves their community as a watchdog with Watchdogs of Southeastern Pennsylvania, where they fought against the Mariner East Pipeline Project, a pipeline for petrochemicals used to make plastics in the EU. To Chris's right is Jeff Dembicki, whose pronouns are he and him. Jeff reports on energy and climate change for DSmog. He is the author of the Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change, which I've heard is for sale in the bookstore here. And it's an excellent book, so I highly recommend it. The Washington Post also named it as a best book of 2022. Jeff's writing has appeared in The Guardian, New Republic, Rolling Stone, Vice, and The New York Times, among others. To Jeff's right is Kate Huangpu, whose pronouns are she and her. Kate is a reporter for Spotlight PA, an investigative outlet covering the state, an investigative outlet. Kate covers the state government. She follows how and why the state government works the way it does, paying special attention to how the structure of the government expands or excludes who can participate in democracy. Much of her coverage focuses on the state's energy and environmental policy, including topics such as hydrogen hubs, abandoned wells, and federal funding for clean energy. And then last but not least, we have Sean O'Leary, whose pronouns are he and him. Sean is a senior researcher at the Ohio River Valley Institute, where he studies economic development and Appalachia's energy economy. He authored the Frackalacha series of reports on jobs and population loss in Appalachia's natural gas counties. He has written extensively about why expected downstream development in petrochemical manufacturing, and more recently in hydrogen and carbon capture, are struggling to get off the ground, and why those industries pose economic and environmental risks rather than promise for the region. So I'm going to throw the first question to Jeff. Carbon capture and storage, also sometimes called carbon capture utilization and storage, is pretty technical, which can intimidate reporters sometimes. I'd love to start by having you walk us through a clear and simple breakdown of what CCS is. Tell us, how does it work and where did it come from?
Hi, thanks for coming out to this. I have a pretty non-technical definition of CCS, and my definition of the technology is that it represents the most potent form of industry climate disinformation these days, and it's also a tool for the political survival of oil and gas. And so carbon capture, at its most basic level, involves capturing the CO2 emissions from some sort of polluting activity and burying them underground. And it has a history going back to at least the 1970s when Chevron used the technology in Texas to extract more oil from depleted oil and gas wells. And so at DSMOG, I primarily report on CCS from the perspective of Canada's tar sands. And so if you aren't familiar, they're the world's fourth largest oil and gas reserves. They're crucial for the business survival of Exxon and the largest refiner of tar sands in the United States is actually a subsidiary of Koch Industries. So the tar sands have always been critical to Exxon and Koch, two of the biggest spreaders of climate disinformation. The tar sands also, it's a difficult resource to extract, so there's a larger number of production emissions. And in the years since the Paris Climate Agreement was signed, the tar sands was seen as particularly vulnerable to the waves of net zero announcements made by governments around the world, including in Canada. And so in recent years, the six biggest tar sands companies have come together and formed a group called the Pathways Alliance. And they've run ads all across the country portraying this industry as a climate leader that is, quote, on the road to net zero. And the way that the industry hopes to achieve net zero is by doing this huge build-out of carbon capture and storage facilities in northern Alberta, right near the heart of the tar sands. And so you may have seen there was some peer-reviewed research that just came out, I think yesterday, actually. Melissa Aronchik, I probably messed up her last name, was one of the authors on that. And they analyzed some of the claims being made around carbon capture and storage by these large oil and gas producers and found that there was a very strong and compelling case for greenwashing when it came to how the industry is talking about this. One of the biggest emissions in all of this advertising being done around carbon capture in Canada is that the companies are not being upfront with people or most policymakers that CCS is primarily a tool that the companies view as enabling them to expand their oil and gas production over the coming years. And the companies also were not upfront in their advertising about the fact that this carbon capture really only deals with the emissions from the actual production process, and that it wouldn't cover at all of the oil that's actually pulled out of the ground and then burned in car engines and other places around the world. And that's quite significant because that represents 80% of the emissions from a barrel of oil and gas. But all of this advertising and disinformation around carbon capture has been quite effective in Canada and also in the United States, where you have federal governments promising billions and billions of dollars now in taxpayer funding to help these carbon capture operations become more economically viable. And so I think from my perspective, then, carbon capture has created a situation where governments are willingly handing over massive subsidies to oil and gas companies that enable them to keep pulling more and more oil out of the ground and basically exacerbating the climate crisis at a time when we need to be rapidly winding down our production and use of these fossil fuels. So I'll end off there for now.
Thank you, Jeff. And before I go on to the next question, I just want to pause on one thing that Jeff said, which was that carbon capture and storage was invented by Chevron to extract more oil. That process is called enhanced oil recovery, or EOR. And of the 32 commercial CCS facilities currently operating worldwide, 22 use most or all of their captured CO2 for EOR. So it is the main driver of CCS at the moment. I'm going to pass it to Kate next, and hopefully you can use the mic down there. Kate, you're our expert on the ground. I'd love to hear about what the state of CCS or CCUS is in Pennsylvania. In what contexts is it being used or proposed to be used?
Is this good for everyone? Okay, great. Yes, so CCS is definitely the center of a lot of attention in Pennsylvania. It's sort of where, like, Senate Republicans and House Democrats and the governor all come together, where by and large they're supportive of it. Not all House Democrats, to be fair. But because of the two hydrogen hubs in Pennsylvania, especially the one out west, Arch 2, which has a natural gas component, they're proposing that there will also be CCS that is paired with that. So that, I believe, is out in Braddock, if anyone knows where that is in Pennsylvania. So that's one context. The other one is one of the governor's new energy proposals, PRESS, which changes our renewable energy standards that the Utilities Commission has to meet, like how much renewable energy we buy. He's now included natural gas with carbon capture as an acceptable one tier of an acceptable renewable energy to meet that standard. So there, it is clearly like a priority within the state government. I know in the Senate Environmental Energy and Resource Committee, they've passed a bill to try to take primacy from the EPA. So basically, Pennsylvania would be able to control where we dig our own injection wells and wouldn't ask EPA for permission. It sort of removes a level of bureaucracy or oversight, depending on your perspective. So, it's definitely a big topic of conversation. It's where a lot of the energy probably will be focused in terms of energy policy in Pennsylvania. And as of yet, I'm not aware of too many lawmakers who have, you know, really come out against it. I know that there's a bill that was proposed to try to install a regulatory framework from Representative Emily Kincaid. But outside of that, I don't think House Democratic leadership has said that they were going to try to pick it up or go forward with that bill. So we'll have to see what comes of it. But yeah, it's definitely a focus.
Two quick follow-ups for you. One, could you report on hydrogen a lot, so could you give the audience a better understanding of the intersection between hydrogen and CCS? And then also, could you maybe share some insight into why CCS has such broad support here in the state?
Yeah, so hydrogen, it's a form of energy that's being subsidized by the federal government. Essentially, there's about $8-9 billion worth of federal money that will be going to support these hydrogen hubs, which are essentially production, storage, transportation centers across the country. We have two that we're theoretically getting money for in Pennsylvania. We're sort of in the early parts of the process. But as a part of that, it's sort of being branded as this clean energy frontier, and carbon capture is a part of that, because you need electricity to generate hydrogen, essentially. I'm really skimming through this, so any scientists in the room, please don't at me. The way you make completely clean hydrogen is by using renewable energy. You use solar, wind, whatever it may be. That's called green hydrogen. The hub out west will be using blue hydrogen, which uses natural gas to create that electricity. But the way that they're trying to make it energy friendly or environmentally friendly is by then capturing that and storing it underground. So those two topics are kind of intrinsically linked. It's also just seen as a way to sort of kind of continue fracking in western Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a long history of oil and gas and the energy industry, and I think amongst environmental advocates, CCUS is sort of seen as a way to slow down the stop of that industry as much as possible and find ways to make fracking more palatable, essentially.
Thank you. I'm going to pass it to Sean now. It seems like a lot of the narrative around CCS in the region is that it'll be economically beneficial. What has your research found? And since we have reporters from all over here, are your findings applicable to other places too?
Yeah, thanks. And pivoting off of a point that Kate just made, hydrogen is an integral part of this because, at least in western Pennsylvania, in Appalachia generally, because it's a blue hydrogen region, you can't actually separate carbon capture from hydrogen. But in answer to your question, one of the driving forces behind the administration's push for blue hydrogen and for an Appalachian hydrogen hub is the belief that it is economically beneficial, that we're talking about a region that historically is pretty poor and which has as a critical element of its economy extractive industries like coal and natural gas. And so there is a pervasive sense, at least outside of the region, that by subsidizing the production of blue hydrogen from natural gas, that we will in that process also help preserve and expand industries that are critical to the region. The great irony of that is that, in fact, the economic benefits that are presumed by many people, and especially in the Biden administration, basically don't exist. I'm sure many of you here have heard of the Appalachian natural gas boom, which began about the year 2008, and which continues today and has made the northeast portion of the United States one of the, well, I think now the second largest natural gas producing region in the world. What doesn't often get covered and what is relatively unknown is that the economic impacts of that boom on the region have been either non-existent or negative. And I'll put a very specific number on it. There are 22 counties in Appalachia that in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia that produce 90% of all the natural gas that comes out of those regions, out of the Northeast. And in those 22 counties, since the beginning of the natural gas boom, they have lost population of more than 50,000 residents, and job numbers have actually declined in those counties. And in fact, those gas-producing counties in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia lead the region in job loss and population loss. And there are many structural reasons for that, and we can get into those later. But it undercuts the presumption that there is an economic benefit that has been touted by Josh Shapiro, Pennsylvania's governor, recently, among others. But the second part of this is that they're doing it in support of a technology, carbon capture, that for many of the applications, and especially the largest applications they're talking about, which are in power generation in particular, it is an absurdly expensive resource. And by absurdly expensive, I'll just put it in two simple facts. If you decide to equip a gas-fired power plant with carbon capture, you immediately double the cost of producing electricity. Literally double. And if you apply carbon capture to a coal-fired power plant, you triple the cost of producing electricity. And that's at a time when gas and coal-fired power are both struggling to compete with renewable resources, which can produce electricity for at or below, in some cases, the current cost from those two resources. And so the challenge for carbon capture is particularly, and you also have to understand that about 90% of all the point source emissions in this region come from coal and gas-fired power. So for carbon capture to have significant environmental value, it almost has to get into those two resource or those two industries which produce most of the pollution. However, it's economically absurd to do so, and frankly would not even be under consideration were it not for the subsidies in the IRA.
Thank you, Sean. And just a quick check, can everyone in the back hear all of us? Thumbs up if you can. Yep. Okay, sort of. Okay, so we'll just all pull the mics closer to us. Okay, after that technical interlude. Chris, I'm going to pass it to you next. An aspect of the CCS or CCUS conversation that sometimes gets overlooked is the transportation and storage of CO2 in pipelines and injection wells. And as Kate spoke about earlier, the state is fighting to get primacy the ability to regulate those wells. And as I heard earlier, right before this, some of you may have heard as well, a CO2 pipeline in Louisiana exploded yesterday. So back to you. You're an environmental chemist by training. Could you walk us through what we know and don't know regarding the safety of CO2 pipelines and injection wells?
I'm so ready. Absolutely. I mean, I heard about that too in the last one from a friend from the Pipeline Safety Trust who's here, that's where I'm going to start with. All right. So with pipelines, people say, it's a matter of when they are going to leak. They are inevitably going to leak. So I started by fighting the Mariner East pipeline, and that is a liquefied natural gas or highly volatile liquid. It is gas, butane, propane, and that thing placed into a liquefied form unnaturally. So it naturally wants to go back from liquid to gas. So when you're doing the same thing with CO2, which is I'm going to give you a story. There's a town in Mississippi in 2020, I believe it is, Satartia. It was one of the worst disasters. It was a community completely unaware of the safety. Their emergency services actually had no idea how to save people. They, in fact, realized that when we have leaks of these types of liquefied gases, it takes out the oxygen out of the atmosphere, so no vehicles able to combust. Their emergency vehicles could not go in and save people who were basically passing out. And I feel like when I read about it, they were saying people were walking around looking like zombies, like it was in a zombie apocalypse. And this is what's the problem of it. So these gases, when they release, they are low-lying, they're heavier in there, and so they want to expand because they're all compressed in. You know, if it was just gas, it would just go. But if it's a liquefied gas, it wants to expand out exponentially, and it starts to lies low to the ground and like goes into like culverts in your basement and stuff. So with CO2's danger is that it's suffocation, asphyxiation, and nothing's going to work. No vehicles. You have to have electric vehicles for emergency services. For mine, HVL, basically it's going to hit an ignition source, which is your furnace or something, and we're basically considered a recovery zone. Through our emergency services, which is scary. So, I mean, that's a risk in pipelines aspect. When we talk about the regulation of that, that comes from the PHMSA, or the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. I love trying to say that. I just call it PHMSA. That's a federal agency, and they look over regulations for pipeline integrity and how they're supposed to be built. The one that CO2 is currently under, except for after Satartia, now the PHMSA is trying to do new rules for CO2 because they realize, you know, it takes a reactionary government, not a proactive government, to make new regulations, and people have to be harmed, obviously, first, instead of, you know, kind of listening to the science. My idea would be that. So they are 49 CFR 195 is what these are. It's called hazardous liquid pipelines. It was originally created to carry oil, fuel, like gasoline stuff. When it is dangerous, it ruins your water. That stuff is bad, but it doesn't go boom. It does not blow up. They have a separate one, which is called 49 CFR 192 for natural gas pipelines, or I call it frac gas. So you have it's inherent because it's about the risk assessment that they do, like how many people are going to be harmed. And that considers what's called high consequence areas. It's actually in the design features of the pipe. So it'll be thicker pipes or, you know, less pressure. So it's if you're going under a bunch of, you know, in a highly dense area. Yeah. CO2 and HVL, much more dangerous products, are not considered in that regulation. They do not make the pipes thicker or lower pressure. So it's really weird to me. I thought that's a gap in it. A lot of us who are fighting this are kind of like, this is a really big gap that has to be handled. And not just like CO2, any liquefied gas needs to be handled in its own manner because the emergency services have no idea how to do it. And we're like self-citing industry of the fossil fuel industry. Really, come on. We're going to trust that they're going to do it great. My personal opinion, no, I'm not going to trust them. So like the other part is injection wells we have to talk about. So as they were saying, we have primacy. Again, I'm just going to say, you know, there are really strict regulations or supposedly guidance from the federal government as to how to properly, you know, inject. It has to go into like a certain type of soil. And yeah, they don't, the one inherent risk is that it can come back to the surface. All right. So that's how important. And if we're going to get primacy, and I've seen how our PA DEP has behaved with fracking, I'm sorry, but I do not want them in charge of this. I don't trust it. I'm a watchdog. What I do is basically the DEP's job every day. So I'm a little bit nervous about injection wells and having primacy. Injection wells are just, I mean, we should not be poking any more holes in the ground. And as well, these rural communities are in injustice communities. You know, what people aren't talking about is when we start perpetuating, you know, CCS because it's tied to fracking. What about the health impacts of these people who have been suffering? Just because they capture the carbon doesn't mean all the health impacts of the community has been actually addressed, and they're just trying to cover it up, to me. And so really, I think the scariest part is the risks in all of this is your health and all of it, and your safety. So did I answer all that? And the data gaps, well, the data gaps are there. I feel like there's no data gaps in our health. And there's a lot of data gaps in how like to properly, you know, build or store CO2. In fact, I would say that most of the data might even say that it's not the best idea. As a scientist, that's what I see. I don't think we should be placing people at risk with pipelines. And you're going to need pipelines in order to transport it. So, you know, awareness is going to probably be each community's necessary thing. And you guys as journalists, really important in that awareness part. So.
You have
One thing that I want to add just about data gaps is that this is really Pennsylvania specific, but we have about 250,000 abandoned wells that we don't know where mm-hmm. they are. And I know I've just talked to a few sources who have said that that's just something to consider when Absolutely. Thinking about where you're putting your injection well. I think there's only one planned right now in Arch 2, but the plans aren't finalized. But the idea of having those two reactive substances. Unintentionally meet is also a source of concern.
That was an amazing point. You're right. I was out hunting these orphan abandoned wells, and we're looking for them ourselves. So yeah, I've seen that. And so that's one of the things in the strict regulation, the federal government, hence, but you know, what we're trying to ask for primacy to get so we can do it. Our state doesn't have a clue where all these orphan abandoned wells are. And I just find them through methane leaking. There's a lot of other technologies we're working on, but we have not caught up. So to sit there and automatically rush this through is really, really kind of scary because they have a lot of poked holes out there, and they have no idea where they're at. So, good point.
Yeah, thank you for raising that, Kate. And speaking of data, Kurt Davies, who's here in the audience, told me ahead of time that Dan Ziegart has data on the Louisiana leak. Am I getting that right, Kurt? I'm not going to be able to repeat all of what Kurt said. There was a lot of good stuff in there. But just to summarize, if you want to get in touch with Dan Ziegart to get data about CO2 pipeline blowouts, talk to Kurt Davies. If you're not already in touch with Dan, he has a lot of good data. And with that, I'm going to move on to the remaining set of questions we have for our panelists, then open it up to you all. Sean, we've talked a lot about CCS as greenwashing and talked about many reasons why it has a long track record of failures, doesn't work. I'm sure some people are wondering, though, are there legitimate uses for it? Could you speak to that, please?
Yes, and there probably are some legitimate uses for CCS. I know last year my organization...
Sean, could you pull the mic a little closer?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thanks. Yeah, there are some legitimate uses. Last year my organization did... an analysis in Pennsylvania of decarbonization strategies looking for optimum solutions. And there are some categories of industry, and you'll hear them mentioned frequently in this discussion, steel making, cement making, some paper, and some glass making, in which there really aren't very many other viable options. Or the options are much more expensive than carbon capture would be. And in that respect, I know some of you in the room were in the previous session that had to do with hydrogen, and it's very much the same sort of picture. In both cases, whether you're talking about hydrogen or whether you're talking about carbon capture, we're talking about technologies that even if they work, which is in many cases unproven, as we've been hearing right now, but even if they work, are very, very expensive and therefore should be last resorts in decarbonization if you're going to decarbonize. So, yeah, there are a few industries, but they are niche applications. rather than the mass consumption applications, when you start talking about things like power generation, that is a mass consumption application. And so there's a very different infrastructure conversation to be had and investment conversation to be had if you're talking about CCS for just the applications where it might be economically appropriate versus CCS in applications like power generation where it's not, because you make an immense leap in going from some applications to others.
Thank you. I'm going to bounce it to you, Chris, again, to talk about your work as a watchdog. You've spent years fighting the Mariner East pipeline, which runs close to your home and transports LNG from the Marcellus and Utica shale fields. If I understand correctly, CCS is not being used in conjunction with that pipeline, but I'm curious to hear how that boots on the ground watchdog experience shapes your view of CCS.
Well, I'm going to answer that really quickly. How did the boots on the ground? Well, I realized a lot of things they're saying they're not doing when you watch them. So the documentation that what I learned, I'm going to say that I think, and this is my opinion, that our Mariner East pipeline, the two pipes that were put in, is actually slated to hold CO2. Because we have Marcus Hook, which is a petrochemical hub. Nobody's talking about that when we're talking about this hydrogen hub there. This is a petrochemical hub. They have a polyethylene cracker plant there, Energy Transfer, how many refineries, Monroe, Braskem. Nobody's talking about the neutralization of all those industries. And so if they were to capture, CO2, they have to put it somewhere. I don't know if they're going to store it in the caves, because I think they're using that for all of the product that they want to make money off of. I think they're going to be transporting it out southwestern Pennsylvania and sequestering it or reusing it if they want to, I guess, for fracking. But so what happened? How did I figure that out? Watching them build the pipe, there are these numbers on the pipe that's required by the PHMSA reg that says this, like all the size. It's called API 5. I can't remember if that's what it's called. But it shows like the type of metal, you're supposed to have the type of metal, like what kind of steel it is, what the size is, the diameter. And with all that, you can go into the PHMSA regulation, and anybody can throw those numbers in, and you can do a calculation. And I realized that one of our pipelines was built at 2,700 PSI, when it's only supposed to run for HVL at 1,480 PSI. And my question was, like, this company has destroyed homes, has destroyed property, and refuses to pay for anything. But why would they spend extra money on steel, acting like they give a crap about us? Like, there's a reason why they do that. They made it thicker so it could hold. It's options that they always want to have. And I feel like they're always 10 years ahead of us in planning. Things are going on under our noses. And the only way I know how to get ahead of that is by watching them like hawks, basically. And I didn't know, I named my drone Hawkeye, so it's for real. So when it comes to what I learned, I mean, CCS is just another false solution. And it's really a perpetuation of an industry that is trying to keep their head above the water when they, and then I'm a little frustrated because we're looking at that same industry for like solutions. They're the ones who willingly have caused all of this. So it doesn't make sense to look at the criminal for help at all, in my opinion. And I constantly see that in the DEP, letting them investigate their leaks, letting them investigate their, spills, which I find to be such bad practice. It doesn't make any sense. Where else does that happen? I don't understand it in Pennsylvania. So when we've had Senator Katie Muth, we were talking about, she is actually against everything like this. So she's my friend and my senator. We work together trying to get something moving in our government. And like, she helped me a lot with the Mariner East. And through that, we just learned that this whole like conglomeration of companies are talking and they're doing things. And then the hydrogen hubs were announced. We knew in Mariner East before that something was going on, but we didn't know these hydrogen hubs were coming out. And now it's all starting to make sense. And now people, I can't say to you, like, it's CO2 that's going to run in here, but why is that pipeline able to run 2,700 PSI, which is actually right in the sweet spot where CO2 runs? So that's what I learned. Possibly there is CO2 going to be CO2. Oh, and Energy Transfer actually has announced and bragged, because they love bragging. That's, I always go to their, sites, and they're bragging about how they have a whole new CO2 and carbon capture sector. And this guy just got, yeah, so... when we have a gigantic Marcus Hook is all energy transfer, obviously they're going to do that. And if they have to neutralize the area, how are they going to become carbon neutral? So it's kind of like a math equation, I guess. I don't know. Logic?
And for those who don't know, what is Marcus Hook?
Marcus Hook is a historical refinery, kind of like the PES. It's a little older, but Marcus Hook has been refining products. You know, Monroe, for example, supplies like our airport. I think it's Delta. So it's just historically a petrochemical hub. That's why how they pushed the Mariner East through and said, we need this pipeline to be able to support the petrochemical hub. Now it's a hydrogen hub. I mean, it's just continuously bombarding an environmental injustice community. And these the accumulative aspects of all those chemicals that I see on my camera, and knowing that I see it several times in these, like, all the time, actually, it's just that knowing that there's people live there, there's people that live there, and their bodies can never detoxify. So they're constantly being bombarded by cumulative, like aspects of just petrochemicals. I mean, they make everything out there, and it's where all the pipelines come through, like the Mariner East terminates there. And then there's also an export facility where they take our stuff over to Europe to make plastic. So it's a mess. And I still say people got to think about that before they say this is green.
Thank you, Chris. excuse me. I'm going to put the last question to Jeff and Kate to answer jointly in the time we have left. We have journalists here from all over who are probably keen to know how to cover CCS in their home communities on daily deadlines and really get past the industry greenwashing of it. What tips would you give them for covering it?
Yeah, so I should mention I am a state government reporter, so this isn't my beat full time. So a lot of my framing is in terms of what the state legislature is doing or what the governor is doing. So for me, what's important is keeping track of what kind of action is happening in, like, the House or Senate Environmental Resources Committee, the Consumer Protection Utilities Committee, checking in on them and the lawmakers who are in charge of whatever bills run through that committee. So the framework for me is typically, like, what bills are being introduced, what bills are being called up, what's going to run. But in terms of, like, getting through the greenwashing, I think a lot of the times it's just talking to advocates and researchers, professors, lecturers, like people who don't have financial interest in the industry. But also, I mean, you do have to, like, listen to what the financial interests say to know what they're saying. But, yeah, it's a lot of advocacy, sourcing, talking to people like Sean, things like that.
And I would say this is non-scientific, but probably like 90% of the stories I read about carbon capture are about how expensive the technology is and how complicated it is. And I think that type of reporting is very valuable, and we should bring accountability to these projects. And I also think it's time to sort of move past that type of framing, because I think it plays very well into what industry wants. Because when questions of technical complexity are constantly raised, the oil and gas industry says, well, these projects are very complicated, and we undertake these massive engineering challenges all over the world, and we're actually the best placed companies to implement these projects. Similarly, with the focus on the high cost of this technology, which is absolutely accurate, the industry loves to also acknowledge that and say to policymakers, this technology is very expensive, but how do you expect us to decarbonize? Therefore, you should give us billions and billions of dollars to implement this stuff, which is exactly what's happening right now. And in all of those discussions, we're basically only focusing on 20% of the emissions from a barrel of oil, which are the emissions from actually producing oil at a specific site. And this is sort of deflected from the expansion plans of all of these companies, which are planning to sell millions and millions more barrels of oil per day every year to markets in Asia, in Africa. And of course, when you burn the oil in those places, it still releases huge amounts of emissions into the atmosphere. And so I think the type of reporting that would be really valuable at this stage is to find the industry talking about what benefits CCS brings to their business model. So, of course, there was the Occidental CEO a few years ago saying that CCS was a way to preserve the industry going forward. That was a very revealing quote. In Canada, the large tar sands companies have presented to the federal government and said, CCS is an invaluable marketing tool for the industry globally because Canadian tar sands producers can say that they're on the path to having the greenest oil anywhere in the world, and then they can use that as a marketing tool to sell more of their product to countries abroad, especially in Asia. And you know, kind of the gold standard for any false solution story is to find an instance of a company publicly saying that they're just supporting the policy for cynical reasons. And so I'm sure you all remember the Exxon lobbyist who was caught on tape a couple years ago saying that Exxon only supports carbon pricing publicly because it knows it will never actually become policy. And so I guarantee you people in oil and gas and the coal industries are saying stuff like that all of the time. And those are the stories that I think can really cut through the greenwashing.
Thank you both. You made excellent points. And I think, you know, what Jeff spoke to about CCS as a marketing tool and what Kate said about, you know, this not being her primary beat are excellent examples of the fact that these stories are in every beat. You can find a way to cover CCS no matter what you cover. So on that note, I'm going to open it up to the audience. I'm going to stand up because I can't see most of you. And I'm going to start with Aaron Jordan here with the first question. I'm going to repeat the question real fast. It was just about water use being used to build and operate CO2 pipelines.
Ooh, water protectors here. So, like, in regards to building, that's an interesting question. I mean, like, I know that in at least fracking, when we're doing fracking, like, there's a large water use, but I might be a little confused about how they're saying, like, water is always, all right, water is a major problem in any construction project because, a lot of them are using horizontal directional drilling to get around places to go underwater resources, but that then ends up having, like, frack outs and also creating conduits that weren't necessarily there into your groundwater system without doing, like, great groundwater impact studies, for example, or any type of impact studies. So as water use, I wouldn't know. They do have to pressure test these pipelines, so, like, there's a lot of pressure testing, hydrostatic testing, they call that. It's a requirement. But I would say mostly it's endangering your water at some point. So, like, though that's my experience as a pipeline. If anybody else has anything here, but I think it's endangerment of your water's resources and your ecology as well as fragmenting your forests and stuff. So that all affects your water, you know? Anybody else? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add is I just know in terms of, like, CO2 storage and stuff that there's concerns about that impacting water quality as well,
wells.
And, like, injection wells, that but I'm not sure sense. If that is included in your project at all. But, yeah, I think it's just disturbing the pore space underneath. And the.
Is it part of your project? Is there injection in this? Or they?
Yeah, there would be.
Oh,
yeah,
that's so where your water is. That's it. It's injection wells because they have to bring the CO2. It mixes with water at a certain point in its process to be able to inject it. Mm-hmm. So, and that's like 5 million gallons, I think, on frack pads at least a day. So, yeah, there's going to be huge water permits that you'll have to obtain. Yeah, good job. Thanks for clarifying.
Kurt?
Don't we already have a problem with that?
Yeah.
Okay, this Pennsylvania's.
This mic is not on, is it? It is on? Okay. For those of you who didn't hear what Kurt said, a lot of the injection happens in saltwater caves, so they need to bring the brine up to the surface, and there are concerns about that brine being potentially radioactive and also just being salty and needing to be stored somewhere. Next question. Yes, in the back. Could you identify yourself, please? Name and outlet? So the question was about the differences in soil consistency and the ability to store CO2. Sean, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, this is a legitimate concern. As has been discussed before, much of the experience that we have with carbon capture has been gained along the Gulf Coast and in that region. And in moving to places like Appalachia or even the Midwest to Iowa, you're dealing in many cases with very different geologies. You may have the salt caverns available to you down there, but for instance, in Appalachia, which is a much hillier environment, they happen at different levels, and that creates different potentials for leakage or seepage to the surface. And one of the pieces of evidence that you'll find for this is that even when you talk to geologists in the region who are working on this, you will find an array of different opinions about which areas of Appalachia are amenable for carbon capture and which are not, and under what circumstances. Mm-hmm. So the concern that you raised, yes, is an absolute legitimate one, and it's one of the issues that causes people to feel anxiety about the potential siting of projects, because given the differences in opinions among experts in the field, there's a sense that there is no consensus, that we really don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Right here in the front.
Hallie Parker, New Orleans Public Radio. So we'll post. All right. Big issue. I was just wondering, because we kind of know, right, that this is all to preserve the industry. But down in Louisiana, that doesn't necessarily mean that people don't want it. I wonder if you could talk about how to communicate that to those audiences and maybe what points to make it a reporting with that.
So the question, just to repeat it for people in the back, was we understand that CCS is to preserve the industry, but in places where the industry is the employer, like Louisiana, how do we communicate that to readers?
I think as Chris and some of the other panelists have pointed out, there are a lot of very compelling environmental justice concerns about all of the build-out of this infrastructure. So potentially even in an area like the Gulf, where there is a lot of support for the existence of the industry, there's still a whole public health angle that I think could resonate with people regardless of their position on the future of oil and gas.
Yeah, so that's actually the story I'm working on right now. But so because these hub projects don't actually have that much details available, we have some basic information about where they're located, but not like the names of the cities or towns. You know the general county or region they're in, and I've just been reaching out to community organizers there, environmental advocates there, and asking, like, what are your concerns? Do you have any concerns? Have you ever even heard of this project? Because I think that, at least in Pennsylvania, is a big question of when will we hear about the details of this project? What will they look like? What are the environmental health consequences? Because in Pennsylvania, too, like, there is a big energy industry here, especially if you couple it with labor. Like, those are two big, powerful sectors in the state legislature. So there is a lot of widespread support, at least in the state legislature. I think it's just when you go down to, like, a community level, a person-to-person level, like, there's also been a lot of examples of times where this has gone wrong, and there's been significant impacts to people's drinking waters or air quality pollution. So finding those stories, talking to those people, and trying to make sure that their voices are heard as well.
And by the way, thank you. Because I was trying to process your question, but it's absolutely public health. We actually work with them as PSRPA. They're formerly known as toxic tours. Now they're solidarity tours. We have a coalition of people. We come back. I'm going to go down there actually and help with the FLIR. So absolutely our tours are focused on health and safety. So, you know, there are people working. There were some workers that came to our tour, and they did amazing things by actually, I mean, in this industry, they were talking about safety from the inside. And I was like, that is amazing. So absolutely, like, elevate those voices of these people who are actually taking that risk, because, I mean, it is the employer. You can't take that away, but you have to talk about the health and safety. So thank you for that.
And I would just add this, that so often these issues are framed as jobs versus the environment. And one of the things that rarely is done, and going back to what I said originally about the economic impacts of the natural gas industry in West Virginia, they don't exist. A great many claims are made that when by industry and by the politicians that support those industries, that when you look into them, they may not be the case. And in fact, one of my colleagues at the Ohio River Valley Institute, an economist by the name of Nick Messenger, recently examined in, I think it was 12 parishes in Louisiana at the invitation of some people down there to look at the impacts, for instance, of Louisiana's investment tax credit and the economic outcomes. One of the things that I think a lot of people who are less concerned, frankly, about the environmental impacts, but who are greatly concerned about the economic and budgetary impacts resonate to, is when those kinds of false claims about economic benefit are exposed. And so I hope that's something that will get woven into the story because it reaches an audience and speaks to sensibilities and motivations that environmental and health issues may not speak to. And that greatly widens the audience for this kind of reporting.
And actually, can I make it just a quick
and then we'll move on to the next
comment?
Question.
When I think everyone hears on the panel the advice to focus kind of to go more granular with these projects can bring about some really interesting politics, too. Because in northern Alberta, where they want to do this big carbon capture and storage build-out, I was interviewing this guy. He was a former TV news reporter turned evangelical country singer. And he hates renewable energy, but he hates carbon capture even more. And there's this whole far-right constituency in that area that is opposing the build-out of CCS. That puts them in political alignment with First Nations who've lived in that area for thousands of years, as well as environmentalists, and also puts them in opposition to the far-right premier of the province, who's a major oil and gas advocate who wants CCS as a tool to preserve the industry. So it's just an absolute mess, politically speaking, but really interesting to cover.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding us, Jeff, that this is more complex than we can imagine and that we also can all become evangelical country singers if journalism doesn't work out.
Oh, my God, please.
Jake?
No.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the other Biden administration hub project, the DAC hubs that they've given to Battelle and Epoxy, I think, in Texas. Like, I guess for Jeff and Sean, I wonder, you know, the idea is to see like a low carbon manufacturing boom with DAC. I wonder what you make of the potential economic benefits. I think they're equally illusory to point source carbon capture. And then also, I just wonder if you could talk about the role you see DAC having for companies like Oxy that have also embraced point source.
So to repeat the question for anyone who might not have heard it, it was about the economics of DAC, direct air capture, and some proposals in the Biden administration. And was it also about effectiveness of DAC?
Yeah, just well, I mean, not the technological effectiveness,
right,
but validity of the claim that it could sort of seed like manufacturing in the places, you know, like cement seal, etc.
You got that?
Okay. You want me to?
Yeah,
you
got
okay. I think it's fair to say that DAC is perceived by most people to be almost a last resort or something that you go to, and it's because of a function of cost and efficiency again. To put this in context, when the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, there was a credit, for the 45Q tax credit for carbon capture, that created subsidy levels for different technologies. So, for instance, for conventional carbon capture, the variety of which we've been talking about, that subsidy was set at $85 per metric ton. For DAC, it was set at $190 per metric ton. And the reason for that is that, obviously, they think it's a much heavier lift to get DAC off the ground, which is a reflection of its relative efficiency. And so, you know, DAC theoretically has potential value, but basically it has potential value if all other things that have been implemented fail. But it's something that, again, does, if it's going to have any value at all, it will require significant government funding to make it possible because there is no private sector market or demand for it at this point. And I should add, by the way, that with respect to the IRA subsidies, we should keep in mind that these subsidies basically have to cover not just the cost of the technology, they also have to cover the cost of money of borrowing in order to meet the immense capital needs for these things, and they also have to cover the profit margins that companies would hope to earn, because if you're a company and you're going to tap your markets to try to get capital to do something, you want to get a return on it, otherwise you're just not going to. And that's part of the reason why the IRA, which is primarily carrots rather than sticks, is so, so horrifically expensive. Recently, the Energy Futures Initiative, which is the group begun by Ernie Moniz, the former energy secretary, they did an assessment of the 45Q carbon capture subsidies and found that even at $85 per metric ton, there were only a couple of applications, one of which, by the way, is ethanol, for which that subsidy will be sufficient to induce companies to actually invest in it. Even $85 a ton isn't enough. They're looking more in the $100 to $120 range, which is obviously going to be a really heavy lift politically at this point at the federal government. And so for that reason, the Department of Energy and the Biden administration are putting immense pressure on state governments to try to enact supplemental subsidies to try to make these things possible.
And I would just say really quick, something that could yield some really interesting stories wherever these projects are being done is to look into the agreements with the local and state governments and see who's liable for the CO2 if it should come out of the ground at some future point. Because the companies might be negotiating, 20 or 30 year agreements, and then in perpetuity, some government is responsible for this carbon for like forever, essentially. And those could end up being massive financial liabilities if some of these underground reservoirs aren't as good as were initially thought.
Yeah, to Jeff's point, by the way, the White House Council of Environmental Quality and the Biden administration are specifically encouraging states to offer companies assume liability at the public level for exactly the reasons that you just mentioned. The other thing that I'll point out about the subsidies, 45Q and also 45V, which is the hydrogen subsidy, they are limited in time. They're not limited in dollar amount, but they are limited in time. The 45Q subsidy only lasts for 12 years after a project has begun, which raises the question, and this is one I've not seen explored journalistically at this point, is what do advocates for these programs expect will happen with facilities that are funded largely through the 45Q subsidy when those subsidies come to an end after 12 years? Do they just turn the technology off? Do they go back to their former polluting ways? What incentive do they have at that point going forward?
Keep fracking.
All the way in the back, blue shirt.
That's crazy.
So the question was, do the problems we see with CCS also apply to carbon capture and utilization projects where captured carbon is used to make other things?
So typically, as we said, carbon capture utilization, CCUS, that's really what we've seen with the hydrogen hubs. Like, that's how they're bringing hydrogen out. So carbon capture, blue hydrogen, is literally like, making hydrogen out of plus CCS. That's kind of, it's gray otherwise. So, you know, when we're talking about U.S., it's, you got the fossil fuel industry using it to, you know, to extract more, you know, fossil fuels. But there's also blending. So I know that they have CO2 blending with, I think it's hydrogen, and they're making fuels. I mean, you know, one of the things you have to think about is if you were doing a direct, if you want to do net zero, right? You want to get to net zero, it means you don't want to be using fossil fuels to capture or reutilize because the emissions coming out of that is going to just, you know, wipe that. But what you can do is, if we did have green, you know, I don't see that happening anytime soon economically, but there are other ways. Like, there's, you know, we're always talking about carbon capture, but there is, like, you know, carbon removal. And that's another thing, because we do have to remove carbon out of the atmosphere. Like, we're past that point where we can't just, like, keep thinking net zero is going to be it. We have to remove. So there is a lot of hope in, like, you know, removing it out and then creating these, like, biofuels. Then you have a net zero, literally, because you're not, you know, creating it through fracking. Then you're having, a zero because you're actually making it from the stuff we've already put into the air, and you can make a biofuel. I don't know if it's biofuel. It's chemical. Let's just say that. But there's a lot of options to that. I think that, you know, if we're going to have that CCUS, we have to be really careful on what it's used for. I mean, that's where we have to pay attention to, and those are the questions that have to be asked. But once you let some people have a system in hand, whoever has that money, they're going to miss. There's a lot of misutilization of it. So I'd be interested in those projects, especially if it has to do with, like, you know, withdrawing carbon out or carbon removal. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I would just add that I think the issue with use is that, you know, right now the primary use for carbon is enhanced oil recovery, which there's a huge debate about the degree to which that does or does not add to or detract from pollution. I think the problem with other potential uses is simply that there's so few, and they would constitute a relatively small fraction mm-hmm. of the total amount of carbon that at least theoretically could be captured. And so I think that's why that has not become a more prominent question.
Yes, you're in the front.
Is there, Bellamy Palethorpe from KNKX Public Radio in Seattle, is there such thing as a good carbon capture project? So how do you quickly recognize it when evaluating things to cover?
Great question. Is there such a thing as a good CCS project, and how do you quickly identify it when trying to figure out what to cover?
I mean, I think for some applications like cement and steel making, you could make more of a case for it because the primary carbon impacts from those industries come during the production process because you're not taking the concrete and, like, burning it afterwards. So in those kind of hard-to-abate industries, I think there's a lot more of a case to be made for the technology, but it still is quite expensive without public subsidies.
Kate?
Sorry. Yeah, the only thing I would add is just, like, in terms of when I'm looking at the ARCH2 and MACH2 hubs, like, in Pennsylvania, the things I generally try to look at are, like, public health, environmental impact, and costs. So I tried as best I can to find out what are the costs, what are the environmental impacts, what are the public health impacts, and then sort of go from there when, like, trying to figure out, trying to assess a project, essentially.
I mean, there are statistics also on the DOE site, like, about it, but there really is no efficient, like, most products, I think they said 9 out of 10 fail right now. But if I do agree with what, you know, Chef said, because, you know, we do have to neutralize, or we have to remove or stop that. Cement is still, we don't have a replacement, I guess, right? So, I mean, these questions are perfect, I think.
Yeah.
Public health.
Yeah, I just think, you know, it should be clear when we're talking both about carbon capture and also about hydrogen, or at least low or, you know, no emission hydrogen, that we are talking about increasing costs. There's no scenario in which carbon capture does not add, and depending on the industry, add very significantly to the cost. Just like when we talk about hydrogen, whether it's green hydrogen or blue hydrogen or any variety of hydrogen, when you're switching from another fossil fuel like natural gas or coal to hydrogen, it's a less efficient fuel for most processes, and you're adding to the cost. Now, that addition can be masked for a while with federal subsidies. But eventually, you know, it comes to the fore. And one of the questions that, again, I think hasn't been sufficiently explored is whether private sector investors will invest in technologies that are fundamentally uneconomic or economic for only as long as the IRA subsidies exist. Because most of the facilities in which we're talking about investing are built to last a lot longer than 12 years in the case of the 45Q subsidy for carbon capture or the 45V subsidy for hydrogen.
I'll chime in and say Chris touched on one thing that we haven't talked about a lot today, but failures. A lot of CCS projects don't meet their stated targets for how much carbon they're going to capture. So that could be another question you could ask of the project. The people who are putting it forward is put that to them, find similar projects and say, you know, X, Y, and Z had carbon capture targets of 90% and they only achieved 45%. That's just an example. But and then ask them, you know, how are they going to achieve the targets that they've set? Because most projects have failed to do that. All right, in the back. Thank you, Joe. We have just a couple minutes left for questions. So the question from Liza was about a proposal in California to not clean up idle wells so that they can be used for green hydrogen storage, and is that carbon, and is that realistic, feasible? Any insight?
Can I try it? Like when you're dealing with these orphan or these abandoned wells, these older wells, I don't know what age ours go back in the 18. They have like wood casings still. I mean, like, they also don't even understand the depth. So when we were in the plugging programs and we're learning about a lot about these wells when they were plugging them, you know, they have no idea what they're going into because the records have been lost. I don't know how if it's the same in California, but in Pennsylvania, a lot of lost records. So these guys are kind of going in blind. And the casings are the biggest failure. I don't understand why we keep thinking that we can put carbon dioxide in the ground and they're not going to have a casing problem with that. I mean, these are not, like, for life. It fails. And so, I mean, I get what they're trying to do is reuse something that's already poked hole, but, like, seriously, wait till they start, you know, going down there and finding out what's really in it, because they have no clue. And I would say it's not a feasible idea. I don't know. I think that's just dangerous.
Yeah, I would add that, like, so I cover abandoned wells a decent amount in Pennsylvania, and the deputy DEP, Environmental Protection Secretary, who does oil and gas wells, said that it's not a matter of when or if a well casing will fail, it's when. Like, all of them eventually need to be upgraded. So I haven't studied whether or not the level of casing required for oil and gas wells is similar to that of CO2. I would think that CO2, like, would need to be stronger. But in the case of abandoned wells, especially in Pennsylvania, most of these are super old and would not be up to standard. So I think it would depend, again, on what California's situation is. Like PK said, like, I can't imagine. Like, I've seen some of these wells. They're real rusty. I don't think anything should be going in there. Yeah.
Yes, right behind Liza.
I just wanted to add, I'm from the community. I'm here on behalf of
Thank you. Any last questions from journalists? So the question, I lost a bit of it due to the clapping, but it was about how do we have a nuanced conversation about CCS? Throw it out to the panel.
I'll take it. Yeah, I'll just take a little bit of exception to the premise. I know, you know, earlier in this session I was asked, or we were asked as a panel, whether there are applications in which CCS would be appropriate. Yeah, I don't have a vendetta against CCS. I don't have a vendetta against hydrogen. There are occasions in which its use would be appropriate. I think the nuanced conversation that you're talking about is one that takes into account what are the relative costs of doing it and what alternatives are available for doing it. And frankly, I think that conversation is one that's being had. I mean, there are people who are, I suppose, ideologically or philosophically opposed to hydrogen or CCS or things like that, but I find relatively few of them.
Yeah, I would add that those people that are ideologically opposed, they're typically like politicians. So I come at this from like a government reporting perspective, and I think what's really important is reporting on what exactly they want to do. So not trying to focus on CCS as a concept, but the practicalities of, okay, well, what does this look like? Like, what does Pennsylvania having primacy over where it can dig its injection wells look like? That's not most times like a sexy conversation. That's like about bureaucracy and what kind of permits we need and why it's good, why it's bad. Like, I've talked to advocates who think that EPA or Pennsylvania should have primacy because the EPA, depending on who is in charge, who the administrator is, like, will be a help or a hindrance. So, yeah, from, like, a government reporting perspective, I think it's all about focusing on what is the reality of what are the plans that are being proposed and not trying to get caught up in, you know, conceptual rhetorical stuff.
I'm going to just say one other thing. Like, so when it comes to any of these projects or anything that we're talking about, nuance, like, we always have to focus on, like, what's important. And it, like, does it harm health? Does it, you know, so, like, I am a scientist, and engineering is engineering. Like, I have no problems with how things are used. But I think at this time, it's who's using it and how they're using it. Like, I will go with anything that we need help, you know? Like, if the science matches, if the data works, you know, I would have that conversation. Just, that's where we're at now. But thank you for that question.
There you go. Thank you all for being here today. Thank you to our panelists, to you all for the great questions. To SUJ and Penn. I will all stick around if you have other questions, but again, thank you for being here.